Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, April 15th. Isn't that tax day? Oh, my gosh.
Here we are.
2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
I wonder why you don't know. I wonder who prepares the taxes around here.
Thank God.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Mondays now of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you'll hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we got another great show for you today that's going to include, what are the risks of surgical menopause? It seems so innocuous.
And what causes the pain with metal-on-metal hip replacements?
I can tell you something about that. And how about salt? We see so many articles about salt, one saying one thing or one saying the other. Is it a friend or a foe?
And how is obesity linked to microbes that live in our gut?
And who's responsible to protect seniors from risky drugs? Is it us, as some people would imply, or maybe it's the doctor's responsibility?
You know, we often hear about menopause, but what about surgical menopause? Now, doctors often recommend that women have their ovaries removed during a hysterectomy to prevent problems with their ovaries in the future. But does this really make sense? I mean, aren't our ovaries important? Well, now new research shows that removing the ovaries may prime the brain for stroke and Alzheimer's disease. This is scary.
Well, I mean, isn't it arrogant to think you know things when you don't know things? We don't understand so much about how the body works.
And talk about being vulnerable. You're going in for surgery to have your uterus removed, and the doctors are like, oh, well, we took out your ovaries while we were in there.
They don't usually just do it that way. They'll tell you in advance that they might decide to do that if there's a need for it. But to do it prophylactically because they think, well, they don't do anything anyway, but what they're really saying is, you know, we don't really know what they do, and it doesn't seem to be important.
But what do you mean they don't know what the ovaries do?
I see what you mean. I'm thinking after menopause, they don't know.
This surgery is causing a premature surgical menopause.
Absolutely, and that's a major problem, because what you're doing is you're taking away important hormones that have a lot to do with our health. So that's right.
And most lay people don't realize the importance, and they depend on their doctors to make those decisions for them.
Absolutely.
You know, so many times in the past, you know, we've talked about this before in our shows about how the doctors used to take, and maybe they still do, I don't know, they take our appendix out while they're already in there doing some other kind of surgery to prevent appendicitis in the future.
Exactly.
Or take out the tonsils.
Well, they've made
the
assumption that they don't do anything. They made the assumption that I was taught that the appendix is a vestigial organ that has no function. Now, who made that up? That was by proclamation. Somebody made the assumption that because we don't know what it does, that it doesn't have a function. But it does. And you ask 100 doctors, okay, does the appendix have a function? I'd say most of them aren't going to have a clue.
Most of them don't know yet.
But there's a lot of information about it, and we know precisely what the appendix does.
And we have fast tracks that we've done on that on our site, drsaputo.com.
Exactly.
Well, also, you know, we've talked in the past about how the doctors used to do these radical mastectomies for breast cancer, where they would even sometimes go as far as removing all the lymph nodes and the ribs and the muscles and everything else.
They actually would take off sometimes the whole upper quadrant, including the arm. And that was a guy named Halstead, you can thank him for that, who thought, well, if there's cancer there, if we take out more, wouldn't that be better?
And so a lot of people still really believe that. And now,
well, not so many anymore, but you're right. This is something that was typical to do up until the 80s, really, when they found out that, guess what? If you do a lumpectomy, meaning just take out the tissue and a little bit more around it, it works just as well or better as this radical deforming surgery does.
So anyway, back to the surgical menopause. How does that increase cognitive decline and dementia?
Well, that's interesting. This was a study that was published in a journal called Brain. Okay, it's one of our prestigious journals. And they did it on rats. And what they, because rats, believe it or not, have a lot of similarities in brain function as people do. And they looked at
that's why we run in circles.
That's right, in our treadmills. That's right. Yeah, there's going to be a big rat in heaven that puts us in treadmills, and we're going to run around there. Anyway, they looked at rats 10 weeks after removal of their ovaries, And they started some on low-dose estrogen therapy right at the start, and others they started at 10 weeks later, and some were not given any estrogen at all. And what they found was is that the rats that were treated late or not at all experienced more brain damage, okay, to a region of the brain called the hippocampus that normally is pretty stroke resistant.
That's right in the middle, isn't it?
Right in the middle of the brain. And what it does is they found that the untreated or late treated rats also began the robust production of Alzheimer's disease related proteins in the region of the hippocampus, which is, of course, a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease.
Well, you know, some people might want to ask here, you know, about HRT, because we know that people that are on hormone replacement therapy have an increased risk of heart attacks and strokes. And we also know that this estrogen deprivation from surgical menopause now also increases the risk for heart attack and stroke. So how do you explain this?
Well, I want to come back to what we're talking about in a minute because I haven't finished that, but it's a very good question. And we make the mistake of assuming that HRT is the same thing as what our body does in terms of making organs, hormones. And you're absolutely right. HRT means premarin, okay, which is pregnant mare's urine that has has an estrogen compound that's typical for horses. The horse mare makes an estrogen that's different than human estrogen. And they give that to people thinking it does exactly the same thing, which, of course, is very disrespectful of nature.
Nay.
Nay is right. And when you're talking about progesterone, Provera is a product that can be patented, okay, by the drug companies because it's not the natural progesterone that the human body makes. They stuck a little side chain in a place where they thought it would be innocuous and said, well, it's going to be the same thing, and so we can patent this, but we can't patent normal progesterone. So we'll put together this Premarin and Provera, and we'll market it to convince doctors that it's the same as what the body does. That's the most ridiculous thing of all time.
And people just expect it. I mean, just expect that it...
That it's right. Yeah, because some doctors said, or I mean, doctors generally say that. Even today, there are a lot of OBGYNs who are saying, oh, hormone replacement therapy, there's no difference between horse estrogen and artificial progesterone than there is between the natural hormones that the human body makes in terms of natural estrogen and progesterone.
But why,
that's just crazy thinking.
Why wouldn't they choose the natural estrogen and progesterone?
God knows. There's no logic to it that I see. Maybe it's peer pressure. Maybe it's those drug reps that are coming to the office that are saying, hey, we did these studies and it shows this, and we think it works the same as natural hormones do, but nobody's done any studies on them, so we don't really know. But I think you know this because we did the study.
Well, many times it helps women with their symptoms of menopause,
sure.
With their hot flashes and so forth.
Yeah.
So, like, nobody's worrying about the side effects, I guess.
Well, that's why they did the HRT study, is because the drug companies actually believed some of the literature was out there that said that if you take HRT at the time of menopause to replace the hormone levels that are dropping, that we're going to have fewer heart attacks, fewer strokes. Women are going to look better. They'll have less wrinkles.
Of course,
their
soon
blood
as you
pressure
tell
will be
that
better.
To women, they go for it.
Well, so, I mean, there was a guy in the 60s that came out and wrote a book called Forever Young, and that started this whole business of the youthfulness that women seem to cling on to so much in a society that looks at beauty as something so important.
But didn't they find out that after the first year that the women had more heart attacks and strokes?
Well, they did. Yeah, they had more heart attacks, more strokes. Their brains were becoming demented at a faster rate. And now, of course, we have these studies that were done, okay, that I want to go back to, that you know, we had these three groups of rats. One group didn't get any hormone replacement early. The other got low-dose estrogen therapy. And the third one got nothing at all. And when they found this, what happened is they saw that there was an increase in risk for heart attacks, strokes, and early dementia. So we're looking at stuff that is really impressive in terms of what it shows. And they related this actually to a reduction in the number of brain receptors for estrogen, which happens when you do early surgical menopause, take out the ovaries. There's a drop in estrogen levels. The brain responds to that by making fewer estrogen receptors in the brain, and particularly in the hippocampus. And so you wound up with all these changes that are the reverse of what you would like to see.
So in other words, the doctors might consider after the surgical menopause doing like natural bioidentical hormones, but
yes,
it seems like they would need to do the lab test to find out what the estrogen levels are, because sometimes
yes,
the estrogen is stored in the fat, right?
Absolutely. Well, estrogen is made in fat. It's also made in the ovaries, of course, make it. The primary source during women who are premenopausal is in the ovary. After the ovaries are removed, fat tissues make a little bit more. The adrenal makes a little bit. And that's what we're left with in terms of what's there. Now, when you take the ovaries out, you have a drop, an abrupt drop in this, because you're not going to make up for what the ovaries do, either in fat tissue or in the adrenal. And so you're right. We should be doing tests to measure estrogen and its different kinds of it, progesterone, testosterone. Should look at thyroid and probably look at adrenal function by measuring adrenal hormones through the day to see if that's been affected as well.
Because all these hormones affect one another.
Yeah, they work together like a symphony. It's not like you're taking a whole bunch of one thing. It's like putting 1,000 bass drums in your symphony and thinking that you're getting a music from it. What you're getting then is something that's not natural.
Okay. Now, one of the reasons we're saying it's not natural is because we're basically talking about women that have this, what we're calling surgical menopause,
exactly,
earlier than what a natural menopause
sure, maybe
would
their
be.
20s, 30s, or 40s. I mean, somebody has vaginal bleeding or endometriosis or some other problem in the pelvis. And it looks like a surgery could solve some of the problems. I mean, if you're bleeding a lot, you take out the uterus, it's not going to bleed anymore. And long as you're there, you take out the ovary so you don't get ovarian cancer. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And so the point you're making here is really a good one. We're way too aggressive.
Okay,
with things that we don't know enough about.
So that if a woman has this early surgical menopause, mm-hmm, it sounds like that it would be recommended to take these bioidentical natural hormones like the estrogen and the progesterone if the lab test warranted, which they probably would because it's not going
to
be making it. But how long do you think it would be safe for them to take it? Because we need to think about where natural menopause fits in here, because it's natural for women to slow down and producing these hormones when
nobody,
they hit menopause.
Nobody knows that answer. You can go clinically, okay, by how a person feels. I mean, if somebody's having hot flashes and sweats and all that stuff, you may want to consider, if they've had a surgical menopause, to go ahead and give them more hormone replacement. So the age, I mean, the real thing is after the surgical menopause, it's important to start hormone therapy. Because now, instead of having a natural way that the body is going to be making estrogen and progesterone, that's going to be gone. And what we have to do then is try to replace that normal rhythm of how it's produced. And we can't, because we're not that sophisticated. The body has innumerable feedback mechanisms that will control when a hormone should be produced and when not. And if you think you're going to get it right when you don't know what the regimen is, I mean, you have to be a little bit silly.
So this is why it's important for people to request of their doctors that they do these lab tests so that they know where they stand and what their body is short on.
Well, that's right. So you really summed it up well there. And these are the kinds of things that we don't think about so much in medicine. We make guesses about what seems logical, and then we move forward as though it's a fact. So when we're talking about doing incidental, we call them incidental surgeries, meaning you're right at surgery and you're doing an operation that somebody needs. I mean, say somebody has diverticulitis and they have a perforation and you got to go in and do a surgical procedure to try and clean up the mess that's in there. And the appendix is right there. We don't know what many doctors don't know what the appendix does. And so they'll just say, well, long as we're here, let's take it out because it may be a problem later. But now that we know how important the appendix is in terms of supplying the body with microbes that will keep the microflora of the gut healthy, we should leave it there. And it's the same thing with the ovary. The ovary's there. Yes, you can get ovarian cancer. It's a fairly rare disease. Is it worth upsetting our hormonal metabolism to take that ovary out under the guise of preventing ovarian cancer? That answer turns out to be no, unless you think trading it for a little dementia is a good idea. And the real issue here is it only a twofold increase in cognitive decline and dementia? Because that's what this study showed. And the answer to that is absolutely not. It's probably everybody has some amount of it because it's the biochemistry that's screwed up. When you don't have estrogen there, and your brain receptors don't form in the brain as it should to try and trigger those reactions that we have to prevent dementia, I mean, you've got a real problem here. You've created something you don't have to do.
Okay, I have a question. What if somebody that's past menopausal age, someone that's postmenopausal, had had this surgical menopause done when they were younger, and now they hear about this new study that says that it can cause dementia and stroke and all that. And, of course, as we age, we worry about having those problems anyway.
Right.
I wonder, in your opinion, do you think that there's anything that these people could do to prevent this from happening to them?
Well,
is it too late?
According to the study, it's too late. But I don't think it's ever too late to do some things to recover what you can. The rats, once they got it late, still developed at a double the normal rate of cognitive decline and dementia. In people, we don't really know what it does, but I would think that even late, you would stop the process of the rapid cognitive decline that would occur from surgical menopause.
So maybe like really upping your healthy lifestyle and cooking with coconut oil.
Well, you do all those things, yes. But in terms of measuring this particular aspect of your health, that's the time when you want to measure hormone levels. You know, you can get them in serum and urine and saliva and measure them. If you find out that they're low, balance them the best you can because the damage is already done.
But it's normal to be low postmenopausal, though.
But how low? And what else does the ovary do postmenopausal? Does anybody know? Because we don't know, it's safe to take it out. That's that same moronic thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting ourselves back in trouble again by making assumptions. I mean, look at the assumption we made about the pineal gland back in the 1960s.
Yeah.
We had no idea what it did. I remember our professors talking to us when we were in emergency medicine saying, the pineal calcifies as you age, and its most important function, because we don't know what it does otherwise, is to show you where the center of the brain is. So if somebody's had head trauma, you'll see if there's a hematoma, a clot in the brain. If it pushes over the pineal a little bit, you know that you may have
some. So it's just a marker.
So it's like a marker. And, of course, now we know all the incredible things that it does. Anyway, this is something that really we should take to heart. If you don't know what it does, don't do something just because it's convenient to do, because you make up a couple reasons why you think that this might be an advantage down the road. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on some facts of life. And when we come back, we'll be talking about what causes the pain of metal and metal hip replacements? You may not think that's complicated, and a lot of people don't even think it's a real thing. I can assure you it is, and I'll explain with Vicki why.
Some great facts of life. Life is sexually transmitted.
What?
Good health is merely the slowest possible rate at which one can die.
Interesting way to look at it.
Men have two emotions, hungry and horny.
Oh,
if you
geez.
See him without an erection, make him a sandwich.
Oh, jeez.
Give a person a fish and you'll feed him for a day. Teach a person to use the internet and they won't bother you for weeks, months, maybe years. Some people are like a slinky, not really good for anything, but you still can't help but smile when you shove them down the stairs.
Wow, a little bit of aggression here today, huh? Okay.
Health nuts are going to feel stupid someday, lying in the hospitals dying of nothing.
That's right.
None of us could take a lesson from the weather. It pays no attention to criticism.
True.
Why does a slight tax increase cost you $800? And a substantial tax cut saves you $30?
That's right.
You know, in the 60s, people took acid to make the world weird. Now the world's weird and people take Prozac to make it normal. And as somebody recently said to me, don't worry about old age. It doesn't last that long.
Unfortunately, it lasts too long sometimes.
You know, too. And as the older we get, the faster the time seems to go by.
Oh, it does. It does. You're right.
When I think about it, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, 17 years ago, that wasn't really very long time ago.
How about 60 years ago? How's that sound?
Yeah, but I was just thinking about, like, how much time we have left.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
That's and when I look back that much time, it doesn't seem like very much time. I don't know why I'm focusing on 17, probably because our first granddaughter's 17. But.
Well, I think if we stay in the moment, we don't have to get sidetracked on that, because if you're focused on length of life, you got to be a little depressed, and you're right. We do all these things that are healthy, and we live a little bit longer. Yeah, we still have to work hard.
Well,
don't
when
we?
You hit a new birthday, it kind of makes you start thinking like that.
Right.
Especially new decades.
I agree.
Okay, so can you imagine having so much pain in your hip that you resort to hip replacement surgery?
Yeah, I know what that's about.
Only to find out that you continue to have pain. Now, nationwide, unexplained pain is on the rise in people with metal-on-metal hip devices. So what's it usually from?
Well, I think when you have a metal-on-metal device, we found that there are real problems with the surface coating that's put on the titanium that has cobalt and chromium most of the time, particularly ones where there's resurfacing done as opposed to hip replacement. Resurfacing means that what you do is you just, if you don't have a far advanced disease, what you can do is you can sand down the rough areas on the head of the femur, which fit into the pelvis to make the hip joint. And when you do, you can put a cap out of metal in the head of the femur and another receptacle in the pelvis so that you have a joint. But that's a very complicated operation that few surgeons can do properly because the alignment issues are challenging.
And you found that out the hard way.
I did. Now, a total hip replacement is a much safer thing, but in theory, it doesn't work as well, at least in my mind, because when you do a total hip replacement, you have to cut off the neck of the femur, and then you put this big device in rather than just putting a cap on the head of the femur. Now, if that goes bad, if a total hip replacement goes bad and it loosens, you have a real problem putting in a second hip, a new device, because there's a lot of scar tissue there. It may not hold well. But if you've done the hip resurfacing operation, you can still cut that head of the femur off and put a total hip replacement in. That'll give you twice as many years. But it doesn't turn out to be necessarily the right thing to do because of the problems with the cobalt that can wear off the surface of that joint if it's metal on metal and it's not put in straight.
Okay, we're going to be talking about two different things that can happen as a result of these hip surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is the metallosis, which right. you had. And I'd like you to define and describe what that was like. And then we're going to talk about what it's like to have what you have now, which many
yeah,
people,
I've had it all.
They just well, they've just published an article about this, about
right.
How people get metal debris in the tissues in the area.
Well,
but
it,
let's start first with what happened with your metallosis and then go into that.
Okay, metallosis means that the amount of cobalt that gets into your system because it wears off that metal-on-metal joint, either because it's not put in straight or because for some reason it just wears off.
So it's systemic and it gets into your bloodstream.
Well, it gets there and it gets into the local tissues as well. And when you have that, you get a toxic reaction from the cobalt that causes basically the pain and the inflammation. But it also causes problems with neuropathies, which I had in my feet as I had this
which
condition.
Which is so ironic because you spend so much time curing people of
well,
neuropathies.
Well, thank God that I could cure my own. That's right. It also can cause problems with cardiomyopathies, which means there's a little bit of congestive heart failure associated with it. I can cause
thick blood.
Thick blood for sure, which is a big issue because that could predispose you to heart attacks and strokes. And it can also make your thyroid underactive to cause hypothyroidism.
And it also causes a lot of scar tissue.
Yeah, the scar tissue may come primarily from the other thing that goes wrong, which is this problem that has to do with what's called AlVal. And basically that's an acronym for, okay, just a little way of saying aseptic lymphocyte-dominated vasculitis-associated lesion. You don't want to have to say that every time. So what we're saying is this AL-VAL thing is something that happens when the body becomes basically allergic to the cobalt that's there and then forms antibodies, antibody response in the soft tissues that can make a real mess out of that joint that causes a lot of scar tissue.
I wonder if they could do a test ahead of time to find out if you were allergic to that metal.
It's possible, but it may be something that's developed once it's there, because who has a whole lot of cobalt in their body? From what? Nobody.
So anyway, it causes this dense inflammatory fluid.
Scar tissue, too. Yeah, that's right.
So this is like local. This is in the tissues more.
Well, this is in the tissues, and it is local, but it causes a systemic response that can result in making people really sick. I mean, in my case, I was near death because of the hypersensitivity part and the toxicity part of
that was
what
from
was
the
happening.
Metallosis, so that wasn't from this aseptic lymphocytic vasculitis.
It actually was both, because the inflammatory response here that you see is the big issue. When you have inflammation, your SED rate, your C-reactive protein go high, your body measures inflammation with tests like
right,
that.
Right, you had all
mine
that.
Were off the chart, and it causes an anemia, and your proteins are lower, and you have a lot of pain, and that was all part of the deal.
So your pain is from this inflammation and the reaction to all this debris. So what is the solution to this? Because you had another surgery where they put in a new hip.
Right.
And now you still
that
have...
That was life-saving.
Yeah, it saved your life, but you also do still have some pain.
Well, see, when you have this condition and there's a lot of cobalt in local tissues, you can't get it all out at surgery because it's impregnated in there and it makes kind of a fibrotic mess. So the surgeon does the best to remove the whole section, then do the total hip replacement, which gets rid of most of it, but the AL-VAL part of it, which is the hypersensitivity reaction, keeps going until your body washes it all out. And fortunately, cobalt is water-soluble, so if you drink a lot of fluids or you exercise, you'll sweat it out, you'll urinate it out, and you'll eventually, over a few years, get rid of most of that cobalt.
Well, this article says it's a good idea to catch it early so that they can do the surgery.
Yes.
Well, like, so you've already had a surgery and you still have some of this.
Yes.
But, like, what do you think that if you had had some other kind of material put in there, like a ceramic hip, that would have been safer?
I think it would have been wiser, because what I had was another metal on metal put in, but with a cap, okay, of polyethylene that was between the two metal pieces. So you don't have the two metal pieces rubbing against each other at all.
Of course, plastic doesn't sound healthy either.
Well, no. I mean, there are problems with that as well, but it's the lesser of two evils once you've found out what you've got, if you have what I had.
Well, then I was thinking about the ceramic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds safer.
It definitely
unless
safer
unless it
from
was
that
made in China, it'd probably have lead in it.
Well, okay. I think that wouldn't be much of an issue here, but you're right. That's funny.
And then the other thing is, too, is that if you fell down,
well, then
God, talk about fear. I mean, you don't want to fall if you have osteoporosis because your bones are brittle. Well, what if your bones are made out of ceramic, which is basically glass?
Yeah, well, it'll shatter if you fall on it, and then you got another problem. So what it boils down to is we don't have a good hip replacement device. It doesn't exist.
So, and boy,
there's
what
nothing
can a
like
person
what Mother
do,
Nature does.
So what can a person do to prevent themselves from having a bad hip?
Well,
boy, that's...
You need to see your chiropractor more often and stay in alignment, because I'm convinced that most of the problems that we see with osteoarthritis of the knee or the hip or even the spine or the neck come from misalignment. And we don't spend much time with our chiropractors because we don't want to spend the money, or we don't believe in it. Or
we wait until there's a problem, and many times then it's too late.
Sure, then you've got wear and tear on the joint, and here you are. So, I mean, that's what happens. And once you have this problem of pain without any other symptoms, you need to have your doctor make a careful assessment of your cobalt level, but also do a clinical examination to see how much pain you're having. Because if you don't remove that cobalt problem soon, it will get much worse, and then this hypersensitivity reaction can be lethal.
Many people resort to cortisone injections, and we know now that those can slow the healing, even though it might make it feel a little bit better.
That's temporarily. That's right. So here we are. Anyway, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about salt. Is it friend or foe?
Pass the salt.
Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
So, is salt healthy or harmful?
I guess it depends on what you read and who wrote it.
Well, how much salt is too much salt? Does it matter if we consume sodium chloride, which is table salt, or sea salt, or Himalayan salt? Have these studies been done? Well, the American Heart Association claims that too much salt contributes to heart and stroke deaths. And we know that sodium can contribute to high blood pressure, but does it raise blood pressure in everybody? So share some of the surprising studies and statistics on salt and its association with heart attacks, strokes, and hypertension.
Yeah, that's really good, Vicki. I mean, when we look at the study that came out, you know, that was saying that too much salt causes 2.3 million heart-related deaths worldwide in the year 2010, I just look at that with a little bit of skepticism, because there's the data on salt, you know, has been out for a long time. And what we're looking at is some people, we all need salt. If you didn't have any salt, you'd be dead.
Especially in the summer and when you sweat.
Yeah, because you lose that. And if you're not, I mean, that's why there are salt licks for animals. I mean, this is something that's a good thing. But taking too much in some settings is a problem. And for some people, it's a bad idea. For example, if you have hypertension, is that a real issue? Well, it depends on who you read.
Or what type of hypertension you have, I suppose.
Well, maybe. But
what's causing it?
In general, if you have exactly what you're alluding to, a kind of hypertension that's salt sensitive, then you're probably not going to want to have salt. If you're in congestive heart failure and you've got too much salt on board and your body can't get rid of it, you're not going to want to take in any form of sodium.
Because had liver disease, too. Huh?
Sure, because sometimes if you have edema related to that and there's a total body overload of sodium that's holding that fluid, you don't want to take more salt because you're just going to hold more fluid.
What about kidney disease? Would that...
Can do the same thing. Yeah, if your kidneys are failing and you're holding onto fluid, that's a big deal. But then, as you are alluding to, you look at an article like the American Journal of Hypertension in the year 2012. They studied 6,250 patients, and they showed that there was little evidence that cutting salt back decreased the risk for heart attack, stroke, or death in people with normal or with high blood pressure. And then you look at another study that was done in the Journal of the American Medical Association in the year 2012. They showed that the less urine sodium there was, which means the less salt you take in, the less salt there'll be in your urine. If you take a lot of salt, your kidneys will clear it. So if there's a low amount of sodium in the urine, meaning you haven't consumed much, there's a greater risk of dying from heart disease.
Wow.
And so the way you can put that together is if you have a low sodium diet, what happens is the kidney will respond by increasing its production of two hormones that increase blood pressure. Now you're getting confused? You should be. And look at the Cochrane Collaboration, a very prestigious group of doctors who are supported in part by the Department of Human Services, Health and Human Services.
And they go over a lot of the studies.
Yeah, they do. They looked at 11 salt reduction trials, and what they said is low salt diets reduced the top number by one point, and the bottom number by about a half a point.
Well, that's not much.
But that means if your blood pressure would have been 120 over 80, now it's 119 over 79.
Yay!
That's nothing.
That's not very significant.
And they reviewed 57 studies, and they said that shows very little evidence for any benefit to cut back on salt.
So how come these studies are pretty much hidden from us?
Well, they're not. They're published. But see, things come out in the news, and they sound sensational. So a study like this last one we're talking about comes out, and it's got fancy names. It's called the 2010 Global Burden Disease Study that was presented at the 2013 American Heart Association meeting. Looks like it has a lot of of solidity because of the people involved. But don't be so sure.
Well, a lot of the conclusions that they come to seem to be projections and not really data.
Well, that's right. It's not that they've done a study looking for an endpoint, okay, that says if you eat this much salt, what's happening in terms of death or complications related to hypertension, heart disease, or stroke? Because that's what this is all about.
Okay, now, the American Heart Association recommends no more than 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams a day.
Mm-hmm.
So how much is that? That's not very much, is it?
Well, let's put it together.
I mean, if you put that in a teaspoon, like okay. That's like, what, about a third of a teaspoon?
Well, let's look at it this way. 3.5 grams of sodium is the same as 8.5 grams of sodium of salt, which is sodium and chloride together. 1 teaspoon of salt has 6 grams of has 6 grams of sodium chloride, but 2.3 grams of just sodium. So they're saying if they're talking about 1,000 or 1,500 milligrams of salt, it's about a half a teaspoon a day, which isn't very much.
You probably put at least that much in your popcorn.
Well, if it's going to taste any good, because let's face it, because salt is something that's been used as a preservative. We use it because it has good flavor. And we have an absolute need for it for life. We don't have it, you're in big trouble.
Well, sometimes if you eat too much of it, though, it does make you eat more.
Well, that's true.
It tastes too good.
Well, yeah, you get caught between.
And then there's sodium and MSG, which makes you want to eat more.
There's sodium in a lot of things, in a lot of places where you can eat more than you need. And eating sodium chloride by itself in excess is not a smart thing to do. And that's what most table salt is.
So basically that's a chemical.
It's basically a chemical, that's right.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about some of these other salts. I know they haven't done the studies on Himalayan salt and sea salt.
Well, they've done some. They've done some. But you're right. They haven't done studies in these particular studies that were reported. Make no distinction between table salt, which is just sodium chloride.
And has no minerals in it.
Has no minerals. It's 97% sodium chloride and about 2%, 2.5% things that change its character so it doesn't stick together. So it's got garbage in it that you don't want that makes the salt easier to use.
Well, you know, I've been thinking there's a lot of talk about sea salt. Like, oh, that
right.
sounds really healthy, sea
yeah.
salt. Then you start thinking about it. Well, there's mercury
yeah.
in the ocean.
And other kind of pollutants. They've got PCBs and other things that are in there that you don't want.
So maybe
but it's still better than table salt because it's got these other
minerals
probably another 85 minerals are in it that your body needs.
But what about the Himalayan salt? That wouldn't have the toxins in it, would it?
Now you're really talking about the best salt there is. And that, you know, is about 85% sodium chloride. That's plain salt. But it's got about 84 different minerals in it that are really something that the body can use. And that's in the other 15%.
Well, you know, you were talking about animals needing salt. That's
yes.
what I give my horses.
The Himalayan
salt. Give them a Himalayan
so they,
salt lake.
So they eat better than most people.
They're getting their
minerals
and their salt.
Come to Vicky's Ranch if you want to have some Himalayan salt. Right, there's a salt lake there. Yeah, well, that's right. So these are all things that we need to take into perspective when we're looking at studies like this because they don't look at the different kinds of salt. They lump them all together. And then you get information you can't trust. Because they haven't really done the study in a way that it should be done to show that the different kinds of salt are different in their makeup.
Okay, so what we need to have a healthy lifestyle is we need balance.
Now you're talking.
So when you eat salt, if you have too much and you exercise, you're going to sweat it out. If you get into a sauna or the spa.
There you go.
And then, like you said earlier, your kidneys are going to excrete the extra and your sweat's going to
right.
kind of help to balance this out.
Right.
But if somebody does have a problem with salt and they have the type of hypertension or
yeah.
they have this liver disease or kidney disease
or heart failure
that we
yeah.
were talking about.
Then you got to be very careful.
There is salt that's hidden in a lot of processed foods.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
hidden in medicines. It's hidden in soy sauce and baking soda and baking powder. It's even hidden in chocolate and ice cream and preservatives.
Well, the salty chocolate's really good, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. <man. laughs>
I love that.
And then, like you said, they use it to cure meats and so forth, but there's a lot of it in soup and in pasteurized cheese and
right.
bread and cakes and pizza and chicken and
yeah,
sandwiches.
Right,
all
right,
those things.
Right, right.
But when I say chicken, like poultry, a lot of times they inject it with the seasonings and the flavors, and they do that with turkey also.
They do that with a lot of things.
So I wanted to give people just a few little tips of how they can season without salt, maybe with some lemon, some lemon zest, sesame herbs, garlic, onions, some organic kelp granules. There's Bragg organic sprinkles, feta vinegar, marinade, low Worcestershire salt, sodium, low sodium Worcestershire sauce, and so forth.
Those are all good. That's great advice. So when we're looking at this whole topic of salt, is it good or bad? Well, it depends on who you are, and it depends on what you call salt. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on an idea, a question, and forgiveness. Can't wait to find out what that's about. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how is obesity linked to microbes that live in our gut, and whose responsibility is it to protect seniors from risky drugs. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
A good idea from Maxine. Instead of the John, I call my bathroom the gym. That way it sounds better when I say I'm going to the gym first thing in the morning. An old man was asked, at your ripe age, what would you prefer to get, Parkinson's or Alzheimer's?
Oh, there's a choice.
Well, the wise old man answered, definitely Parkinson's disease. Better to spill half my wine than to forget where I keep the bottle.
All right, there's a point.
Okay, toward the end of the Sunday service, the minister asked, how many of you have forgiven your enemies? Well, 80% held up their hands. The minister then repeated his question. All responded this time, except one man, Walter Barnes, who attended church only when the weather was bad. Mr. Barnes, it's obviously not a good morning for golf. It's good to see you here today. Are you not willing to forgive your enemies? I don't have any. Oh, Mr. Barnes, that's very unusual. How old are you? 98. The congregation, they stood up and they clapped their hands. Oh, Mr. Barnes, would you please come down in front and tell us all how a person can live 98 years and not have an enemy in the world? Well, the old golfer trotted down the aisle, stopped in front of the pulpit, turned around, faced the congregation and said, I outlived them all. And he calmly returned to his seat. You know, I've heard some old people say that's why they don't want a funeral, because nobody'd come. All their friends are gone.
Well, the ones that are living a long time. But, you know, as old people, you can make young friends, too.
Yeah.
I think we do.
Yeah. I think
are we old?
I think it's a good idea. Yeah. Anyhow, you know, it turns out that a breath test can detect a person's susceptibility to weight gain because an overabundance of this microflora called M. smithii, that's a gut microflora, can produce hydrogen and methane gases in the intestine that are associated with obesity. Now, intestinal microflora are important for our health. They, you know, we've talked about this many times on our show. They regulate immunity. They discourage leaky gut syndrome. They help our digestion. They keep out toxins and many other things. But let's talk about the overgrowth of this M. smithii and how it's related to obesity and diabetes.
Okay, that's really a good question. And I'm not convinced that what this study is suggesting is actually true. Because what they did is they found that people who had this microbe present, this M. smithii, was associated with people who were overweight. And what that could mean is that people who are overweight are allowing, because of what they eat, for this microbe to grow. So that wouldn't mean...
Rather than the other way around.
That's right. And so you wouldn't really know, but it's an interesting concept. You know, now that we're getting into the microflora of the gut being important and causing heart attacks and strokes and digestive problems and so many things, we could be getting carried away a little bit in terms of...
Well, it seems like the authors of this study were trying to assume that the gases cause the weight gain.
Well, I mean, what they found is that when they did this study is that this particular microbe produced two gases in kind of high percentage. And what they did actually is they did a study that was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism that showed that people whose breath had high concentrations of both hydrogen and methane gases were more likely to have a higher body mass index and a higher percentage of body fat. That's a very interesting thing to notice, and I don't want to discount it, but I also don't want to jump to conclusion to say that this is something that is necessarily going to be associated and the cause, okay, of people being overweight.
Well, they said that the hydrogen efficiently extracts the nutrients from the food and that could lead to weight gain plus a little more insulin. But, you know, if this theory's right, I mean, would this be good to give this to the malnourished?
Well, who knows? I mean, we got the cart so far in front of the horse here that it's hard to know what the answer is going to be. And trying to make a lot of projections, I think, gets us in a lot of trouble.
Well,
but
anyway,
that's what research is for. You know,
yeah,
that's why we do research, is for people to do things like this, to make an association, to go out and do the tests, and they've got some idea what next test should be.
Are they found in probiotics, this particular?
No.
Well, you know, microflora are incredibly complex communities.
Oh, for sure. Well, what they're planning to do is another study, okay, that looks at people who are at risk for type 2 diabetes. They have the metabolic syndrome. And what they're going to do is basically see if they give an antibiotic to people who have high levels of this microbe, this M. smithii microbe, and see if that changes their tendency to remain overweight. Now, it's an interesting study. I'd like to see the results myself. I'm not holding my breath because, first of all, trying to find a microbe find an antibiotic just going to kill this one microbe is asking for a lot.
Well, please hold your breath. I don't want any of that gas to come out.
All right. That's fair enough.
Okay. More research shows now that seniors on Medicare are apt to be on potentially harmful high-risk medications when there are often safer alternatives where the benefits of safer substitutes often outweigh the risks of the prescription medicines.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Brown University study shows, now listen to this carefully, that 1 in 5 seniors are on risky medications. And another study shows that most seniors are on between 5 to 7 prescription medications a day. So I was figuring that if 5 people are on 5 to 7 medications each for a total of 25 to 35 meds, how can only 1 in 5 seniors be in a risky medication? That doesn't add up.
No, it doesn't.
Do the math.
Yeah, well, see, you did the math. I didn't this time. So I'm appreciating what you did because you make it look silly, which it is. What they're trying to say is
all medicines are potentially risky.
Yes. Well, it depends on what you define as a risky medicine. So if you think an aspirin is a risky medicine, you'd be right, because a certain number of people are going to have bleeds in their brain, and they're going to have bleeds in their eye, they're going to have GI bleeds. Is that dangerous? Well, I'd say it's dangerous, but I'll bet that aspirin wasn't included in this list.
Because they said prescription meds.
Yeah, well, that's right. But aspirin can be given as a prescription as well.
Yeah.
And you're right. Non-prescription medicines are a big deal, too. When you look at the side effects and complications of a medication, and I invite you to do that,
go to
Google.
Just like the NSAIDs, for example.
Yeah, look up NSAIDs, and they wouldn't probably consider that risky either. But if you think it's okay to have 30,000 deaths every year in this country and to have 300,000 hospitalizations, then it's not a risky drug. And look at the things it does. I mean, it can cause heart attacks and strokes in substantially increased amounts, cause GI bleeds, renal failure. I mean, you're looking at drugs that, I mean, all these drugs, like Vicky's pointing out, have side effects. And when you add them up, it may be there's a 10% risk of indigestion, or an 8% risk of having a headache, or a 6% risk of having some other complication. You add them up, you're looking at 50, 60% of people who are taking almost any drug, they're going to have some side effect that's going to interfere, because it interferes with cell metabolism.
Okay, so we're not telling you to not take your medicine.
No, not at all.
However, if doctors prescribed things like a healthy lifestyle and herbs and supplements, there'd be less need for risky medications. Like, for example, instead of some of these anticoagulants that can be extremely dangerous, there's things like fish oil and nattokinase. Why not try that first and see if that helps?
Or a little ginkgo biloba or something called urokinase. There are lots of approaches that can be taken that doctors who know nutrition well, these so-called orthomolecular doctors who are using things that are natural to try and treat and influence cell biochemistry in a way that's healthier are way ahead of the pharmaceutical industry.
But don't try to treat yourself instead. I mean, if you are taking any of these dangerous anticoagulants,
you need to
tell your doctor that you're taking fish oil or nattokinase.
Keep in mind, okay, that you wouldn't want to do that on your own anyway. And your doctor probably is not going to know the effects of nattokinase or lumbrokinase or fish oil or ginkgo biloba.
Well, tell about the study you did yourself. You did one on yourself with the fish oil and the nattokinase when you had your horrible, we were talking about your hip.
Cobalt poisoning.
You had that thick blood.
My blood looked like glue, and the red cells were in clumps of hundreds, and the platelets were in clumps of hundreds.
This is not a live blood cell analysis.
Yeah, there were fibrin strands all over the place. All I had to do was take a gram of fish oil. All went away.
You waited an hour and did it again.
Yeah.
And it all went away. And the next time you went, you did the same challenge with the nattokinase. So we know that it works.
For sure it works.
But that's why it's not good to just do it on your own either.
Well, look at the problems you get into with a drug like Coumadin. You know, people don't want to take warfarin, which is Coumadin, because it's rat poison for a good reason. Because if you take it in large amounts, you'll bleed to death. And a lot of older people particularly are at risk for bleeding, and so putting them on that would be a very risky thing.
What about that other drug, that Xarelto?
Xarelto is another one. There are several new drugs that are antithrombin drugs that there's no way to reverse. I mean, Coumadin you can reverse. These drugs, once you're anticoagulated, that's it. So if you had
a bleeding stroke
or a GI bleed, or you were in an auto accident, or you fell and fractured a hip, you're in deep pucky.
Because you cut yourself shaving even.
Well, yeah. And the things that are used are the drugs that are used most of the time are drugs that are very powerful anticoagulants.
So, well, then another thing is that many times in the elderly, there are drugs that are just ordered for people that can be dangerous, like statins, for example.
Isn't it
pretty routine to order statins for people in their 80s that don't even have a history of arteriosclerosis?
Right. If somebody has an abnormal cholesterol, you say the level's a little high and the LDL's a little high and the HDL's a little low, well, they don't go after trying to reduce the inflammation. They just say, here, take this statin. And, of course, statins have innumerable side effects. I'd invite you to go to drsaputo.com, put statins in the search box, and you'll get 20 or 30 or 50
videos. So who wants to prolong their life if they're going to feel miserable?
Well, if you're in that group that has a problem, but in the older age group, you're going to see muscle weakness.
But you said, like, it's prescribed in people that aren't, that don't even have the problem prophylactic.
Well, that's right.
So what could a person do instead of that for a prophylactic?
Well, get a healthier lifestyle for one. I mean, reduce the inflammation. I mean, that's the best way to treat cholesterol problems. Diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep. You're looking at the big things. Control your weight a little bit.
Then what's the problem with giving people with hypertension drugs?
Well, I mean,
they're over 90.
Well, somebody even over 80 or 70. You know, if you lower blood pressure enough, and it may just be that you take somebody with, say, a normal blood pressure of 200 over 110 and lower it to 120 over 80, the reason that blood pressure was high is because it took a lot of blood pressure to force that blood to go through a narrowed artery. And then all of a sudden, when you lower the blood pressure, there's not enough pressure to get it across that block, and you may induce a stroke or a heart attack or some other damage to an organ that's got compromised blood flow.
Well, many times it makes people very weak and very lightheaded.
It can mess up your electrolytes. It does a lot of things. Most doctors now are beginning to understand that diuretics also cause a loss of magnesium. And if you have enough loss of magnesium, you can't correct the potassium deficiency that goes along with diuretics because it interferes with how the sodium pump works. It's a long, complicated story.
Anyway, when I was reading this article, I thought, well, the authors have the audacity to blame the elderly for not checking their drugs out.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
I mean, the doctors and the pharmacists are the ones that are prescribing this and giving it to the patient, and they're supposed to be responsible for teaching them. I mean, somebody that's really, really old, they need help to know when to take it.
How about they need a doctor who understands this stuff? Wouldn't that be like the way the system is
designed
to work?
And they should probably have a family member go with them so that they understand when to take it and everything. You don't just put the blame on them. Oh, yeah, that 90-year-old should be on the internet checking it out. Do a Google on your...
It's crazy. And look what happens in convalescent hospitals. Very often people are on 20 drugs. in convalescent hospitals. They're all, and a lot of them are standing
and nobody's
orders.
Done the studies on how they interact and conflict with one another either. It's crazy.
It's nuts. So let's not put the responsibility for knowing if you're on a dangerous drug on the shoulders of the patient. Let's see if we get some doctors educated in medical school and in their training to do what needs to be done to solve that problem.
And then they end up giving them medications to treat the side effects from the other medications.
All right. We're at the end of the show. We'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news in health the first and third Monday of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, you can go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week. We'll see you next time.